Warm welcome now to our next guest, Professor Linda Yu, Fellow in Economics at St. Edmund Hall, Oxford University, and Adjunct Professor at London Business School. Professor Yu, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Janet. Always good to be here.
Absolutely. So, Professor Yu, this morning in the United States, we got somewhat disappointing GDP figures as well as stickier than expected inflation figures, and that is starting to diverge quite a bit from what's happening in the EU. Can you give us just a quick top-line comparison of the inflation trajectory across the pond versus what we're seeing here?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's fascinating because the U.S., even though growth has actually slowed just 1.4% in the fourth quarter, that is actually a stronger growth rate than what we're seeing in the U.K., in the Eurozone. And that's what's accounting for, I think, the more rapid move of inflation downwards. So, for instance, the U.K., has seen inflation drop dramatically to 3%, and actually in a couple of months expected to hit 2%, which is the target. And you already see that in the Eurozone. So the countries that share the single currency, they already see inflation at 2%. And some of the drivers behind it are indeed economic weakness. So again, the U.S. has slowed, but we're talking whole year growth in the U.K. and the Eurozone are probably just around 1%. So that means that you are seeing price pressures come down considerably. But what's also quite interesting is it's not just economic weakness. It's also that you're not getting the supply side oil shocks that had been a driver of very high inflation here in Europe, despite the economic weakness. So we know there's still ongoing Middle East tensions and the tensions now with Iran and the U.S. means that people are looking very closely at what's happening in terms of oil. But so far, that actually hasn't translated into another inflation shock. So both headline inflation and core inflation, which strips out energy and food, both show slowing. And I would just finally add the economic weakness that you see on the side, you really begin to feel it in the unemployment figure. So this is, again, I think fairly striking. Unemployment in the UK exceeds 5%, which is the highest in nearly 5 years. And if you think back to 5 years ago, that's right after the 2020 lockdown. So unemployment was pretty elevated then. Wage growth has come down. And I think that's what's underpinning this quite unusual, I would say, the beginning to see this unusual divergence between Europe and the U.S.
So let's talk about the growth trajectory in Europe. And, you know, the fact that Europe may be growing more slowly than the United States is not a surprise. That's been true for quite some time now, perhaps even decades. But there had been talk of late of this increased sort of renewal in Europe, increased defense spending, increased innovation as a consequence of many factors, perhaps leading to higher growth rates. What's changed? Or is this just something that's more deeply structural that will take time to generate more growth?
I think it's going to be the latter. It's going to be deeply structural. So you're right. You know, the U.S. has always had, really in recent decades, just a higher potential growth rate. And the U.K. kind of sits between the U.S. and Europe, literally, as well as in economic terms. But continental Europe has really struggled with about 1% growth, and that's been the case since 1980s, 90s, certainly. And in fact, one of the most striking statistics is, you know, we talk about Japan's lost decades of growth. So after the real estate bubble burst in the early 1990s, Japan grew slowly. But even in that period, Japan actually grew more rapidly than Europe. So that just gives you a sense of the structural issues. And so Mario Draghi, who was Prime Minister of Italy, probably better known as the central bank governor of the European Central Bank, the president of the ECB, he did a very detailed report on some of the structural impediments that Europe needs to address if it's going to be able to grow more quickly, for instance, at American rates. And there is a generalization. This is a generalization, so just bear with me. There's a saying that America innovates, China imitates, and Europe regulates. So one of his main, of course, that's not entirely accurate because, you know, we know that, you know, the innovation coming out from China and, you know, Europe as well. But I think the, you know, the perception is around Europe being not quite, not as nimble in terms of how the U.S. regulates and indeed even how the U.K. regulates. So there is more reporting, more red tape. You see it in the environmental side. You see it in terms of permissions to operate. If you want to start a business, it takes longer in continental Europe. And then overlaying that is, you know, fragmented regulatory system. So the European single market is actually, in population-wise, larger than the United States, but it's not a single market. The number of impediments that if you wanted to sell across Germany and France to, you know, to basically to treat it as if it were one market with half a billion people is just not possible. So those are among the things that Mario Draghi pointed out and would actually help raise Europe's growth rate structurally. And then also the final piece, which, again, is longstanding, but I think I'm beginning to see some change here, is that financing in America is mostly from capital markets, whereas financing from Europe is mostly banks. So roughly speaking, the proportion of financing, of corporate financing in the U.S. is 80% capital markets, 20% banks. It's reverse for Europe. So that suggests that if you're heavily reliant on national banks, then you also don't have some of that risk-taking behavior that firms, you know, that banks are most tolerant of. Capital markets are arguably more likely to support. So things like startups, when they get to a certain size, they tend to list in the United States. They look for U.S. backers, venture capital. So all of that, I think that depends why Europe has grown more slowly. But I would say on the financing side, you are beginning to see a bit of a change where European banks are partnering with U.S. private equity, for instance, and you're beginning to see more of an ecosystem of that. Europe, but the European companies still do complain about the fragmented regulatory system.
Professor Yu, I'm sorry, we have some breaking news right now, and we have just a headline because the story is still rapidly developing, and it's from CNN Politics that I'm quoting this morning. The Supreme Court of the United States rules that Trump's sweeping emergency tariffs are illegal, and I'm reading straight from CNN Politics website right now because that seems to be the primary source reporting this right now. Quote, the Supreme Court on Friday ruled that President Donald Trump violated federal law when he unilaterally imposed sweeping tariffs across the globe, a striking loss for the White House on an issue that has been central to the president's foreign policy and economic agenda. Quote, the decision is arguably the most important loss the second Trump administration has sustained at the conservative Supreme Court, which last year repeatedly sided with the president in a series of emergency rulings on immigration. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the majority opinion, and the court agreed 6-3 that the tariffs exceeded the law. Quote, the president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs of unlimited amount, duration, and scope, Roberts wrote for the court. In light of the breadth, history, and constitutional context of that asserted authority, he must identify clear congressional authorization to exercise it. The emergency authority Trump attempted to rely on, the court said, quote, falls short. I know that this is just breaking news right now that hasn't fully developed, but I was wondering if you would care to comment on the impact of that decision.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in some ways this ruling was anticipated because the tariff challenge actually came from, it's gone through the lower courts. So it's gone through the trade court, it's gone through the Court of Appeals, and the it wasn't unanimous in the lower court. So there's always some doubt. But this ruling is essentially that the reciprocal tariffs that were issued on Liberation Day last April exceeded the authority delegated to the president by Congress. So trade, you know, tariffs, the ability of the U.S. administration to interpret the International Emergency Powers Act, it's an act of Congress, Not having a duration, which sounds like was one of the bases of the Supreme Court ruling, was always going to be one of the reasons. It was one of the reasons why the lower courts thought it exceeded the president's authority. And this is a massive deal, a massive ruling for how the Trump administration can has what they will do with these reciprocal tariffs, which have been imposed on over 100 countries. I mean, a lot of those have been reduced, but this is extremely, you know, the coverage is absolutely massive. But, and here's the big but, this is the one set of powers the president has used to impose tariffs. He has also imposed tariffs using other powers which were not challenged in the Supreme Court. For instance, the Section 232 tariffs, which were imposed on steel and aluminum. And those, for instance, impact something like 400 products being shipped from the UK. So there's other ways to impose tariffs, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the reciprocal tariffs, which is the economic centerpiece of his tariff regime, has been ruled by the by the top court that the U.S. President administration has exceeded its authority. So it raises questions around trade agreements, including the one negotiated with the UK, mm-hmm. which reduced the reciprocal tariffs. So a lot of things I think are going to have to be re-examined on the back.
And we had been discussing that, you and I, on the show for some time, that mm-hmm. there were still a lot of outstanding questions regarding the implementation of these emergency power authorization tariffs, whether a lot of these trade deals would need to be negotiated, whether they could be finalized at all. The reaction from the markets, pretty salutary. The markets had been down. They're up right now. The Dow currently up 115 points, the S&P up 23 points, the NASDAQ up 126 points, a turnaround that we're seeing from the earlier gloom that the market reaction was positing due to the weaker than anticipated GDP figures. Of course, much remains to be seen what the fallout of this will be now that the U.S. cannot collect on these tariffs, how the administration plans on implementing tariffs using other powers, as you'd enumerated, and what role Congress will now play to step in and either implement or knock down some of these tariffs, and whether refunds are due to any of the companies that have had to pay tariffs under the emergency powers authorization. All of that remains to be seen. All of that is still being clarified and still developing as news this morning, but certainly a lot of questions. And I think the biggest ones, as you point out, is what that means for the trade deals that have been negotiated.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the market's somewhat muted reaction, as you've described, is I don't think anyone thinks this is the end of tariffs. I think it'll be tariffs by other means. But what will be interesting is whether or not Congress now takes a stronger stance. So all of the executive branch's trade powers are delegated powers by Congress. So another example is some time ago now, the Fast Track Authority, which was granted to the executive branch by Congress, that had actually expired under the Biden administration, which means trade deals can't just be fast-tracked. So Congress, depending probably on what happens in midterm elections, if you do have a shift there, could begin to roll back some of this. But I guess another fiscal impact from today's ruling, because November is still quite a long ways from now, is the reciprocal tariffs were estimated to bring in pretty considerable revenues, originally around $50 billion a month and actually going up from there. So quite a few analysts, rating agencies were looking at the revenues being added to U.S. Government, the balance sheet, and actually seeing that as a positive. So that will also probably prompt a bit of an examination about whether the other tariffs levied under different pieces of legislation, delegated powers, are those going to be ramped up? Will that change some of the fiscal picture? And also importantly, what will the U.S.'s trading partners now do? Because the tariffs upon which the trade agreement struck with the U.S. Between the U.K., the EU, and others That I think all need to be revisited. Wouldn't that be interesting if they actually had to issue a refund check? I'm not sure that you've actually seen that, Janet, in a trade.
Yeah, it's not clear how any of this will be resolved yet. This is, still at a developing story that, of course, we'll cover in greater depth as the details become clearer. But it does prevent that $2,000 tariff dividend check, I think, from going out that the president had promised. It also, I think, has impacts possibly for the trade deficit equation, for deficit financing in general, more broadly in this country. Those are big developing questions because the tariffs, of course, had been a centerpiece of the broader economic policies enacted by this administration. If we think back to last year at this time, the tariffs being touted as a way to defray part of the costs of the One Big Beautiful Bill. So this raises questions again about the financing of all of that. I think it just adds complexity to an already uncertain situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are exactly the issues that markets, investors, companies will be looking very hard at. I think the immediate assessment, and just looking at some of the reactions in terms of importers already, you can begin to see some of them see their share price increase because it's expected that they will. Costco had sued the Trump administration seeking reimbursement. There's quite a lot of, I think, corporate thinking now that's going to be placed on whether or not they are due a refund, whether or not they could see prices come down. But I actually think the overwhelming impact will be more uncertainty and firms holding off until they work out what the reaction of the administration is going to be because tariffs are unlikely to go away. So if tariffs just get ramped up in other areas, I don't think it's necessarily going to change the cost structure for U.S. importers anytime soon. And that point about the rebate check being sent to U.S. consumers, that's because the tariffs are inflationary and there has been greater pass-through of those costs to, to households. And so that rebate check was meant to take away some of the pain of the tariffs. But if that's now uncertain, I also think that's not going to help the economic growth picture. And I think uncertainty is probably also one of the reasons why we saw Q4 GDP just dampened a bit.
Professor Yu, thank you again for joining us today.